Okay, so we are today looking at Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 2. And we're doing right through from text 12 all the way through to text 29. Most of it's descriptive, and then text 29 we have a purport by Srila Prabhupada. So I was thinking, actually, let's read the English translation once of the verses, and then we can recite the Bengali verse together. Okay, and then I'll read that translation one more time. The joints of his hands and legs would sometimes become separated by 8 inches, and they remained connected only by skin. Sometimes Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's hands, legs, and head would all enter within his body, just like the withdrawn limbs of a tortoise. In this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to manifest wonderful ecstatic symptoms. His mind appeared vacant, and there were only hopelessness and disappointment in his words. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to express his mind in this way. Where is the Lord of my life who is playing his flute? What shall I do now? Where should I go to find the son of Maharaj Nanda? To whom should I speak? Who can understand my disappointment? Without the son of Nanda Maharaj, my heart is broken. In this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always expressed bewilderment and lamented in separation from Krishna. At such times, he used to read the shlokas from Ramananda Rai's drama known as Jagannath Vallabha Natak. Srimati Radharani used to lament, "Our Krishna does not realize what we have suffered from injuries inflicted in the course of loving affairs. We are actually misused by love because love does not know where to strike and where not to strike. Even Cupid does not know of our weakened condition. What should I tell anyone? No one can understand another's difficulty. Our life is actually not under our control. For youth will remain for 2 or 3 days and soon be finished. In this condition, O Creator, what will be our destination?" Srimati Radharani spoke thus in distress due to separation from Krishna. "Oh, what shall I say of my distress? After I met Krishna, my loving propensity sprouted, but upon separating from him, I sustained a great shock, which is now continuing like the sufferings of a disease. The only physician for this disease is Krishna himself, but he is not taking care of this sprouting plant of devotional service. What can I say about the behavior of Krishna? Outwardly, he is a very attractive young lover, but at heart, he is a great cheat, very expert in killing others' wives." Srimati Radharani continued lamenting about the consequences of loving Krishna. "My dear friend, I do not understand the regulative principles given by the Creator. I loved Krishna for happiness, but the result was just the opposite. I am now in an ocean of distress. It must be that now I am going to die, for my vital force no longer remains. This is my state of mind. By nature, loving affairs are very crooked. They are not entered with sufficient knowledge, nor do they consider whether a place is suitable or not, nor do they look forward to the results. By the ropes of his good qualities, Krishna, who is so unkind, has bound my neck and hands, and I am unable to get relief. In my loving affairs, there is a person named Madana. His qualities are thus. Personally, he possesses no gross body, yet he is very expert in giving pain to others. He has 5 arrows, and fixing them on his bow, he shoots them into the bodies of innocent women. Thus, these women become invalids. It would be better if he took my life without hesitation, but he does not do so. He simply gives me pain. In the scripture, it is said that one person can never know the unhappiness in the mind of another. Therefore, what can I say of my dear friends Lalita and others? Nor can they understand the happiness within me. They simply try to console me repeatedly, saying, 'Dear friend, be patient.' I say, 'My dear friends, you are asking me to be patient, saying that Krishna is an ocean of mercy and that sometime in the future he will accept me. However, I must say that this will not console me. A living entity's life is very flickering. It is like water on the leaf of a lotus flower. Who will live long enough to expect Krishna's mercy? A human being does not live more than 100 years. You should also consider that the youthfulness of a woman, which is the only attraction for Krishna, remains only a few days. If you say that Krishna is an ocean of transcendental qualities and therefore must be merciful someday, I can only say that he is like fire, which attracts flies by its dazzling brightness and kills them. Such are the qualities of Krishna. By showing us his transcendental qualities, he attracts our minds. And then later, by separating from us, he drowns us in an ocean of unhappiness. In this way, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu lamented in a great ocean of sadness, and thus he opened the door of his unhappiness. Forced by the waves of ecstasy, his mind wandered over transcendental mellows, and in this way, he would read another verse as follows. My dear friends, unless I serve the transcendental form, qualities, and pastimes of Sri Krishna, all my days and all my senses will become entirely useless. Now I am uselessly bearing the burden of my senses, which are like stone blocks and dried wood. I do not know how long I will be able to continue without shame. Of what use are eyes if one does not see the face of Krishna, which resembles the moon and is the birthplace of all beauty and the reservoir of the nectarian songs of his flute? Oh, let a thunderbolt strike his head. Why does he keep such eyes? So, of what use are eyes if one does not see the face of Krishna, which resembles the moon and is the birthplace of all beauty and the reservoir of all the nectarian songs of his flute? Oh, let a thunderbolt strike his head. Why does he keep such eyes? Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The moon-like face of Krishna is the reservoir of nectarian songs and abode of his flute. It is also the root of all bodily beauty. If the eyes of the gopis are not engaged in seeing the beautiful face of Krishna, it is better that they be struck by a thunderbolt. For the gopis to see anything but Krishna is uninteresting and indeed detestable. The gopis are never pleased to see anything but Krishna. The only solace for their eyes is the beautiful moon-like face of Krishna, the worshipful object of all senses. When they cannot see the beautiful face of Krishna, they actually see everything as vacant, and they desire to be struck by a thunderbolt. They do not find any reason to maintain their eyes when they are bereft of the beauty of Krishna. Om Agyanti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Nilitamyena Tasmai Shri Gurune Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitamyena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragnatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jugatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gauranki Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadadha Shiva Sadigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, thank you for having me. Thank you for, well, I'm assuming you're giving me permission. And also, I'm hopeful that you will give me your blessings to speak about a section which is actually really rather difficult to speak about. It's extremely deep. But just to get everybody in the same place, because as is natural, everybody's going to be in different places with their readings and studies. So we are on the Madhya Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is the middle portion of Lord Chaitanya's life. And the middle portion of Lord Chaitanya's life is largely to do with his preaching, post-taking sannyas. And it's really the Antya Lila that's to do with his ecstatic symptoms. But we find that actually the way the Madhya Lila is laid out is in the first chapter, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he first of all gives us a summary, much like Krishna gives us a summary in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. He gives us a sneak peek of what's to come ahead. But in this chapter, he gives us a glimpse of the Antya Lila. And one of the reasons he does this is because he is older in age. And so he's concerned he may not be able to complete all of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. And he does not want us to be bereft of really what Lord Chaitanya exhibits and sets an example for us of. I'm tempted to read all 15 verses. Is it 15? 17 verses again. But what I might do instead is select some highlighted sections instead. And it's interesting because what we've come up to so far, the preceding verse before we started, verse 12, actually explains it's already started describing how Lord Chaitanya was exhibiting his ecstatic symptoms. I mean, his mind is vacant, he's grinding his teeth, he's rubbing his face against a wall, it's bleeding. Really, you know, when you first come into Krishna consciousness, if someone told you that would be your state when you achieve the highest goal, I'm not sure many of us would. You know, if you take up this process, you know it will drive you crazy. But then we're reassured that actually the only person who can actually fully exhibit all of the ecstatic symptoms is Lord Chaitanya. That doesn't mean we are not capable of experiencing all of them. But what it makes clear is that actually really for the material body to be able to contain what we experience is impossible. Because if our joints became 8 inches apart, I'm pretty sure you would all be considered, you know, clinically not present. So, you know, there is the expression of the highest here, but also something there to ground us and reassure us. You can have the highest, but you're not going to be, I'm not going to ever make you suffer so much that, you know, in that moment, your body's going to end up having to do things that it wouldn't typically do. Having said that, there is a madness in falling in love with Krishna. There's a madness even in ordinary romantic love. But in falling in love with Krishna, that madness goes to a different level. In fact, if we look at it, love's quite a paradox, because when we truly love, sometimes the distress actually outweighs the pleasure. But with transcendental love, and that's really pure love, the distress is pleasurable. And that's very unusual, because for us to understand, you know, this is one thing, this is difficult to understand if we approach it with intellect. These are matters of the heart, which is why, you know, Prabhupada calls Chaitanya Charitamrita the postgraduate study, because it really is coming from a place of bhakti. Bhakti is from the heart. It's not from intellect. You know, we look at the different modes. We look at Shastra, and there's some element of intellect there. There's psychology there. There's physicality there. And there's bhakti there. But really, to approach it, Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially topics like this, we have to come from a position of heart, and not just the material heart or the psychological heart, but the spiritual heart. So I'm going to go through some selected sections, because you know this verse, actually let's start here and then go backwards. Of what use are eyes if one does not see the face of Krishna, which resembles the moon and is the birthplace of all beauty and the reservoir of the nectarian songs of his flute? Oh, let a thunderbolt strike his head. Why does he keep such eyes? So the moon-like face of Krishna is the reservoir of nectarian songs and abode of his flute. I'm going to actually use this. So in the purport, it's interesting. Prabhupada says that when someone cannot, I mean, he's speaking about the gopis here, but actually this love we have for Krishna, whether it's as conjugal, friendship, parental, Krishna's face is so captivating. Even for Mother Yashoda, Krishna's face is so captivating. Even for Krishna's friends, you know, they may throw things at him and, you know, chase him and climb on his back, but he is so captivating that when they're in separation from him, when we are in separation from him and genuinely connecting with that feeling, everything is seen as vacant. And we may as well be struck by a thunderbolt. We may as well lose our lives. And they do not find any reason to maintain their eyes when they are bereft of the beauty of Krishna. What is the point of living if I'm separated from Krishna? What is the point of existing? Now, this is what Prabhupada's explaining to us, is actually this is our natural desire, our natural constitutional position is to be in such a condition of being loved up, as they say, that actually, you know, we can't bear to be away from him. A moment really does feel like 12 years or more. Okay, that desperation. And it's interesting, some of these verses that said, in this way, Lord Sri Chaitanya, so this is verse 27, lamented in a great ocean of sadness, and thus he opened the doors of his unhappiness, forced by the ways of ecstasy. Have we heard that before? Has anyone ever taken an ecstasy pill and told you that it brought forth waves of unhappiness, which they wanted more of? No, they say they want the happiness from the ecstasy. They don't want the unhappiness. And yet, Lord Chaitanya is opening this, his great ocean of sadness and opening the doors of his unhappiness, which is forced by ecstasy. Isn't that a paradox? Yesterday we were doing a talk for Senna Nights Live. This is this 14 to 16 year olds, youth from the schools. And we were looking at choice being a paradox. And paradoxes are interesting because Krishna consciousness is full of paradoxes because we have been given full knowledge, complete knowledge. Everything is there. So everything contradictory can exist at the same time because we understand it from every level. You know, one of the most common ones we're familiar with is Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva, simultaneously one and different, right? That's a paradox. How can you be one and be different? So similarly, how can extreme happiness give rise to extreme sadness, which actually feels like extreme happiness and makes you want more of it? Now, this is a paradox. This is real love. And imagine having, if Bollywood and Hollywood changed their movies, so people were craving for unhappiness in their romantic relationships, things would look really different, wouldn't they? I mean, our movies maybe may not be so entertaining. So materially, we can't marry this paradox. Why do you think we can't marry this paradox? What is it about us in this conditioned state that makes it very difficult for us to feel happiness in distress in any sustainable way? What makes it difficult for us to... Okay, the duality we live in, how does that duality manifest? Why are we here? Because we're... We had a desire, and you're saying we wanted separation. Why did we want separation? What were we trying to fulfill? Shishradha Gokul Nandaji ki jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Gonita ki jai. We want to be independent. What does independence mean? That I put myself first. Yes? I put myself first. I want you to make me the boss, Krishna. And whilst we put ourselves first, then put ourselves in a position where we completely submit to someone's love and the way they treat us, the way they make us feel, and every emotion that comes with putting somebody else first is very difficult, isn't it? Because in any romantic relationship, you know, we hear this all the time, even Prabhupada cites this so much, that even when somebody is infatuated, just pure infatuation, not even fallen in love, we are absorbed, okay? That absorption is quite temporary though, right? What happens? What interferes with that absorption? Material reality, not spiritual reality, material reality. So the material reality of mistakes, the material reality of shortcomings, the material reality of, hang on a minute, whoa, I'm more important than your pain. My happiness is more important than your happiness. And when that gets in the way, we start to close ourselves off to experiencing love, to receiving love, even material love. Because there's this constant feeling of, I want to be first. Yes, agreed? Isn't that there? That we protect ourselves in loving relationships with this idea that I should put myself first. Whereas here, we're hearing in all of these verses that actually, even Father Rani, she says it here, where did she say it? So this is verse 20. Srimati Radha continued lamenting about the consequences of loving Krishna. My dear friend, I do not understand the regulative principles given by the Creator. I loved Krishna for happiness, but the result was just the opposite. Yes, we approach Krishna for happiness as well. She's saying, I'm feeling just the opposite. I actually went to her for happiness, and now I'm in an ocean of distress. It must be that now I'm going to die, for my vital force no longer remains. This is my state of mind. We have this concentrated set of verses where Radharani is explicitly talking about how painful it is to love someone who is the reservoir of all pleasure, the reservoir of all beauty, the reservoir of all good qualities, and he has used them to trap her without considering social circumstances, without considering the fact that she's married, without considering time, place, anything. Because she says Cupid is crooked, love is crooked, it just manifests. And then he just disappears and leaves her in such a distressed state, but she wants more. Okay, she wants more because that distress is very different to the distress we feel when we miss out on love here. Because when we miss out on love here, we put ourselves first. That's why we miss out on love. Am I making sense? And like I said, this subject is very difficult to open up with the intellect because matters of the heart. If you love someone, if you try to convince another person, your best friend, to also love that person with logic and reasoning, it wouldn't work. At best, you could get them to be favorable to that person. But to actually have a genuine experience of that love for that person, it's got to be something that you've got to engage in. Okay, so we can't, unless we are engaging in a process which brings us to a point where we can share and feel and experience the same sentiments as Radharani. This is just going to be philosophy and theory and be very interesting and, you know, mental gymnastics and entertaining. She also actually talks about his very transcendental nature. He personally possesses no gross body, yet he's very expert in giving pain to others. He has 5 arrows and fixing them on his bow, he shoots them into the bodies of innocent women. It's interesting when we read verses from, you know, conversations between the cowherd boys and Krishna or Srimati Radharani lamenting or the gopis lamenting, there is always a very clear, almost acknowledgement that, hang on, we know this personality is not ordinary. We know Krishna's not ordinary. We understand this. And yet he's behaving worse than an ordinary person. I left ordinary things behind to find some happiness and someone transcendental, and now I'm in more pain. So we're never away from some reminder, some gentle reminder that actually, you know, this is a special person we're talking about. So coming back to the verse of today, verse 29, Srila Prabhupada saying actually it's our constitutional position. It's the identity and state in which we are most happy and satisfied, where we are feeling pleasure and pain in such a way that they both give us pleasure. And it feels so different to our current identity. Feels a mile away, doesn't it? Feels miles, miles and miles away sometimes. And sometimes it feels so close. So it's like, oh yeah, I get it. And then it goes away. It disappears. We get a flicker of it. So what I'm hoping to share with you today is actually that it's not so far away. Because the process we have, the process of pure devotional service, is the direct path to experiencing and living in eternal identity. We were talking about, a couple of weeks ago in one of the sanghas, we were talking about addictions. And when people hear the word addiction, they immediately think of drugs and alcohol, substances, yeah, something beyond, outside of themselves. But actually, as devotees, our biggest addiction isn't objects or things or even other people or even feelings. Our biggest addiction is ourself, the identity we have here. Why is it our biggest addiction? Well, if you look at an addiction, what is an addiction? What is the difference between just using something, misusing something, having habitual use of it, and then progressing to addiction? What's the difference? How do you know you're addicted to something versus you're able to use it in a healthy way? Yes, you have no control over it. It controls you. Anything else? You cannot live without it, okay? You become disturbed when it's taken away. Yes, when somebody removes this ego or crushes it for us, we become disturbed, don't we? Think about it all the time. Don't we think about ourselves all the time? Right? What am I going to do to them? Which I are we thinking about? Anyone else? What else? What other aspects of addiction? Never have enough. Yes, you want more and more and more. Why? Because it is our nature to exist, it is our nature to feel, it is our nature to love, it is our nature to know everything. You know, this Sat-Chit Ananda, to exist, to always exist, to be manifest, to experience, I am here, is our nature. So we are used to experiencing that in this and in this. And the problem is we become addicted. Addiction also means dependent. We become dependent on identity here as our primary way of existing. Okay, and when we're addicted to it as our primary of existing, Krishna very kindly says, okay, let me give you the process of pure devotional service from Shraddha to Prem to help you to move from a place where your identity controls you to a position where you control your identity here. Yes? Isn't that what Varnashram is about? Isn't that what studying Shastra is about? It's about us understanding that actually our true identity, how can we get more in touch with that? So that our identity here isn't annihilated, at least not initially. But initially we are using it in such a way that actually ultimately it speeds up our progress to understanding who we are. That is the first step towards moving from the... Actually, no, the very first step to moving from addiction is admitting you're an addict. Any of us who think we're not addicts, then it's going to be very hard for us to stop being addicted. It's going to be very hard for, if we have to at least first of all, you know, we talk a lot about introspection. And I think it's really helpful if we can first acknowledge that actually my identity here is important to me. Because what happens is when we're honest, we shed a lot of karma. And when we lie to ourselves, we don't allow Krishna to remove things. Okay, because what we're saying is I want to live with my lie. It's the addict who says, I'm not addicted. They can come to the clinic as much as they want. They can see you every week, every day, come to every group. If they think they're not addicted, every facility, every tool, whether it's, you know, therapy, medication, peer support, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because they're saying, yeah, you're wonderful, but I don't need this, right? So until we actually, you know, it's actually important to me who I am here, what I am here. By acknowledging that, we say, okay, but is it a bit too important? And which parts of me do I give so much importance to that they distract me from my spiritual life? And we can all take a personal inventory of that. What I wanted to share a little bit about is actually the scientific nature of our process. I mean, we read this and it feels so miles away from when we're at the beginning of devotional service or the middle of devotional service that sometimes we give up. Yeah, sometimes it can feel like, you know, even Radharani saying it. We only live here for 100 years. Our life is like just a drop of water on the leaf of a lotus. Is one lifetime really enough to receive Krishna's mercy? Is it really enough? And then we hear on the other side that actually just takes a moment, one moment to surrender. How long does it take us to get to that point? But we have this process. We have a process from Shraddha to Prem where we've had pure devotional service. And what do we mean by pure devotional service? That means unmotivated, uninterrupted, unalloyed, favorable to Krishna. Okay? This is pure devotional to Krishna, not to anybody else. Okay? This is pure devotional service. We have pure devotional service in practice. We have pure devotional service in ecstasy. And we have pure devotional service in pure love or in love. And from Shraddha to Prem, we have the stepping stones for us, for our success, to make the transition from our addiction to this identity to actually fully living our true identity, which is actually in Krishna's loving embrace. Whether that loving embrace is externally manifesting or whether it's manifesting in the heart by missing him, in whichever rasa we have, this is our process from Shraddha to Prem. So, I mean, the time we have left, we can't go through every stage in depth, but if I can serve in some way to assist by going through the steps briefly, and how they relate to pure devotional service. So let's start with the first one, Shraddha. That's faith, right? Very obvious. But it's important to understand that in pure devotional service, where does that faith sit? Where does our faith in pure devotional service fit? What sit? Where does it... Who's it seated in? What's it seated in? Because faith is just... Faith can be in anything. So in pure devotional service, where does that faith reside? Who is it in? Can you speak? Sorry. In the heart of the pure devotee. And for us, where do we put our faith? I need to, If you can speak up. We have faith in Guru and Krishna. Yes, it's really important. I know it sounds like I'm teaching a grandmother how to suck eggs, but it's like we need to understand that Shraddha for pure devotional service is actually faith in Krishna, exclusively in Krishna. And actually Shraddha is a stage, even though it's the first stage, it's a stage we repeatedly visit. It's not, okay, I've gone past Shraddha, I'm now in Sadhu Sangha, now I'm in Bhajan Kriya. It's not, we repeatedly visit because our faith is constantly being purified. Yes? Right? In the beginning we start, we think we have so much faith in Krishna. We have all this raw faith in Krishna, we have raw faith in Guru, we have raw faith in devotees. But we get tested. We go through different layers and we shed different other attachments, the things that mix into devotional service so it stops it from being pure devotional service, right? Attachment to good karma, attachment to beauty, fame, wealth, attachment to siddhis. Yes, attachment to freedom from suffering, that's what liberation is. Yes, we approach Krishna for four different reasons. So they can get mixed into Shraddha. So Shraddha is, we revisit Shraddha. As a devotee progresses, our Shraddha changes. Okay? So the next step is Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Sangha is, in its truest sense, somebody? Anybody? Okay, associating with devotees of Krishna. How do we associate? Krishna Katha? Yes. Okay. Which, for the benefit of everybody, please? Yes. So we have our six loving exchanges. And what makes us, because those six loving exchanges, giving and receiving of prasadam, giving and receiving of gifts, and revealing our mind in confidence and hearing from others in confidence, how is it different in pure devotional service? Because those six activities, business people do those as well, right? Somebody wants their business to be successful. They'll go out, they'll eat together, they'll give each other gifts and bonuses and, you know, little perks, and they'll reveal their mind in confidence. Oh, let me let you in on, I've got some, you know, I've got an update. Nobody knows this yet, right? Okay, everybody does this. Friends do this. What's different? How do we do it differently as devotees? Selfless, okay. We can be selfless in other parameters. What's the key thing in devotional, in pure devotional service? It's Krishna-centered, yes. So it's either Krishna-centered or it's in the pursuit of making us Krishna-centered. Okay, so that is the key difference. Just two bodies in a room together who have tilak and kantimala but engaging in prajalpa isn't necessarily association. Okay. Now, this doesn't mean we can't talk about other topics, but those topics, you know, our barometer, what's our two most important regulative principles in Krishna consciousness is always to remember him and never forget him. Okay. So if as friends, in our friendships, we have situations which are making us forget Krishna, then we have a duty as a friend to help each other, whatever it may be, to help that person to revive their Krishna consciousness. Or what can we say to help this person to remember Krishna? Okay, so associating with devotees. Does this change? So just like our Shraddha changes, does our association, does Sadhu Sangha change? Is it a part of our stepping stones that we revisit? And if it changes, how? How does it change? Yeah, can you say more? Okay. So the type of exchange, so the depth of the exchanges will change. Okay. Also, how about who we're associating with? Does that change? Okay. So the more deeper we want to go, we start to change our association. Some of it's very conscious, but some of it's unconscious. And some of it's Krishna reciprocating. You know, we always hear, if you take a step towards Krishna, he'll take 10 towards you. It's not just in matters of the heart. It's also in a very practical sense. The minute any desire or sincerity to go deeper, to come closer, to shed, to let go, happens in our heart, Krishna starts to reciprocate by changing things around us, even the very people who are in our lives. And sometimes he has to remove people from our lives who previously maybe we took a lot of joy in that relationship. And we get some inkling that maybe this having this relationship isn't so helpful in our spiritual life anymore. And he gives us a little, you know, nudge for internally, And then he gives us a little pinch. And unfortunately, sometimes he has to give us a kick. And it can become very difficult. So association changes. Then what's the next step? After association, we have after sadhusanga, we have bhajan kriya. Yes? So bhajan kriya is? In pure devotional service, what is bhajan kriya? Who can give me the definition of bhajan kriya in devotional service, in pure devotional service? Sorry? Clearing stage is anartha nivritti. Yes. Regulated spiritual practices under the guidance of a spiritual master. Okay? So this is two types. We have steady and unsteady. And as our regulated practices become steady, the process of anartha nivritti, or removal of unwanted things, those blockages, those things that keep us addicted, like the false ego, like the enemies of the mind, like weakness of heart, all of these things, they start to be removed. Now, anartha nivritti, anybody who's ever done a course looking at our stepping stones from Shraddha to Prem, we'll see that anartha nivritti is put as a very distinct step. Okay? Anartha nivritti is always happening, even from the point of faith. The reason it can be put as a separate step following steadiness in bhajan kriya is because it accelerates. When we get some steadiness in our regulative practice, it's the anartha nivritti is much more consistent and much more deep. Yeah, it's like cleaning a room. Rather than sporadically cleaning a room, you're like, right, I'm going to tackle this now, you know, and you deal with it. Because you're not scared of what you're seeing. I mean, or you can be scared, or it can be disgusting, but you have a process and you trust your process, you have faith in the process. So bhajan kriya is dynamic. It starts off as unsteady. It becomes steady, and as it becomes more steady, anartha nivritti takes place. This is when the addict is truly, you know, we're truly saying, okay, you know what? I'm addicted, and even though, you know, I'm not seeing any results yet, I'm going to do everything I can to engage in this program in such a way, I have full faith that this will work. And at that point, you know what the difference is between trusting the process and not trusting the process? Is that it gives us a willingness to let go. Our anarthas are held onto just as much as they are created. Okay? So we've had these anarthas created, manifested, reinforced by the choices we make, by the offenses we commit, by the sins we commit, and even the pious activities we engage in. But removing them is just as much a choice as and a choice to let go of them as it is a removal. Krishna's mercy removing, right? If you have a tumor, can the doctor remove it without your permission? No, you have to give consent. Okay, we have to give permission. So permission comes when we are ready to let go. And sometimes our suffering feels safer than the pleasure that comes afterwards, especially sometimes when we read things like this. Actually, if I start to wake up, am I going to stop being able to exist in this world? And actually, after we go through most of our clearing stage, we reach this stage of nishtha. Nishtha is one is fixed in their faith, they're fixed in their practice, fixed in body, mind, and words. And this is the point at which our sadhana bhakti, we can really start to see that there's two aspects of sadhana bhakti. So we have sadhana bhakti as vaidhi bhakti, that's practicing the, you know, approaching Krishna through following rules and regulations and our sadhana. And then there's raganuga bhakti, which is spontaneous devotional service in practice. What's the difference? Because actually, externally, both raganuga bhakti, or spontaneous devotional service in practice, and vaidhi bhakti, externally are exactly the same. What's the difference? What happens when we reach a point where we are ready to shed this identity? Okay, so your motivation is different, yes? So what's the motivation? What's our motivation in Vaidhi Bhakti? What are the things that motivate us to practice? What keeps us chanting? What keeps us chanting when we're in Vaidhi Bhakti, where there's not yet any spontaneity developed, no attraction yet to serving Krishna? purification. What does purification mean? If I was a lay person, I didn't know anything about devotional terminology, what does purification mean? Okay, so we engage, so at Vaidhipakti, one is engaging in chanting, reading, hearing, service, because they want to remove the unwanted things. Okay, what else? We're attached. Okay, so we've made a vow. Okay, what else? Why else do we do it? Say that one more time. Okay, so there's some desire to come back with Krishna. What's more stronger than that? It's a necessary step, though. So that maybe there's some element of avoidance of the consequences of not engaging in devotional service. Peace of mind. Okay, peace of mind. What else? And why do we follow theory? What is it that drives us to follow theory?
Shastra, if you have faith in Shastra.
Faith, absolutely, faith. Yeah? Interesting. Attachment to doing the right thing. Okay. Are these bad reasons? No, they're not bad reasons. They are necessary at Vaidhipakti. And they fuel Vaidhipakti. We shouldn't, when we're on a journey, there are some parts of that journey where if we treat them with disdain, it's not helpful. Okay? If you're walking on a path and you don't like the footpath, oh my God, I don't like this footpath. Just, I can't bear it. It makes us disengage with the journey. Okay? So there are parts of Vaidhipakti which, start to feel dry after a little while. They become difficult. But if that then makes us give up, because we're thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I'm a devotee, I'm practicing all of these things, and yet nothing is awakening in me, I seem to be continuing purely on faith, on sincerity, on being committed to my vows. There's nothing wrong with that. That is the fuel for Vaidhipakti, okay? And the qualification to perform Vaidhipakti is actually faith in scripture. Without faith in anything, we can't begin. What's the qualification and impetus in Raghunuga Bhakti? One has developed a strong attraction, or even some attraction for Krishna. Okay, let's go back to the addict. Until the addict gets a glimpse of what life is like to have a clear mind and a clear heart and a healthy physical body, without drugs in their system. Most of the rehabilitation process is based on faith and I should. Yes, I should do this. I'm doing it for my family, or I'm doing it because I want to be healthy. They haven't yet seen what life is like. Because even when you stop taking drugs, it takes time for your body to get detoxed. Depending on what your substance of choice is, with alcohol, it can take 12 to 18 months for the body to reverse all the changes after you've been addicted for alcohol for a long time. People often have depression for about 18 months after they give up alcohol because it takes that long for the mind and the brain to heal. So for us as well, we can be doing all the right things, but actually for our true self, our true identity in that loving relationship with Krishna and the residents of Vrindavan, for that to manifest, there can be a time lag. Okay? We call that anartha nivritti. We say, be patient, weather the storm, hold on tight, take shelter of the devotees, take shelter of your peer group, the AA group. We can call ourselves MA, Materialists Anonymous, I don't know. But, hold tight. So yes, this glimpse, this affection or attraction for Krishna happens in the heart. Now, actually, Krishna can do anything. He gives it to us actually before, long before we're qualified for it. Many of us have had different experiences. Maybe there's been an awakening of maybe some sort of feeling towards Krishna or an attraction to particular pastimes where you find yourself very spontaneously attracted. Maybe there's certain services you find yourself very spontaneously attracted to. Maybe particular forms of Krishna you find yourself spontaneously attracted to. But having that glimpse is an impetus to, if we have it especially before we have reached Nishtha, it gives us an impetus to, okay, hang on a minute, I got a glimpse. Although I might not get to taste this yet fully or even regularly, let me use this as a reason to still engage with the shoulds. Because I know now the shoulds can work because Krishna has given me a glimpse. Yeah, he's given me a glimpse of what it's like to be not addicted. So with Raganuga Bhakti, what we find is that greed to attain spontaneous devotion, the desire to serve in the mood of the residents of Raj. Because, you know, we're reading here how Radharani is feeling. Theoretically, we can't say, oh, I want to be in a state where the love is so deep and so painful that the painful is pleasurable, or that actually I'm not scared of losing my sense of self here so much that I'm rubbing my cheeks against the wall out of madness. That doesn't happen theoretically. It just doesn't make any sense. We can't fall in love theoretically. Is that love? To do it theoretically, it isn't, is it? So that attraction, as it awakens in the heart, we continue the same processes, the same chanting, the same reading the same books, the same deity worship. But the mood and the impetus behind it isn't I should, isn't I have to, isn't it's best for me. It's I want to, I really want to, because when I don't, she first starts off with, anybody know the difference between taste and attachment? So ruchi is taste and ashakti is attachment. I think I've asked this before. So the difference between taste and attachment. If I have a taste for sweet rice, what's my relationship with sweet rice? Okay, so first I was eating it just because I'm supposed to. It's good for me, you know, protein and carbohydrates and da-da-da. And prasadam. So good for body, mind, and soul. So now I've got a taste for it. What does that mean, to have a taste? It means I like sweet rice now. I like it. I really like sweet rice. So that's taste. So I like Krishna. When we're at taste, Raganuga Bhakti is taking us to taste. I like Krishna. I like being with Krishna. I like his associates. I'm starting to see him as a person. That doesn't mean he's standing right in front of you straight away. But when we're reading, when we're hearing, we can conceive, and it's not imagine. Conceive is very different to imagine. Imagine means we make it up. Conceive means, conceive is when a woman brings forth. Our mind is able to bring forth by Krishna's mercy, because the blocks have been removed, his form, his quality, his pastimes, quite spontaneously. It's really wonderful and sweet. Okay, so I like sweet rice. I like Krishna. I'm going to go and do arati because I like thinking of Krishna in this particular way when I'm worshipping him on the altar. Okay, it doesn't become about how many times you know, turn the incense around the deities and four to the belly, two to the tummy, three to, you know, it's just not about that. It becomes about, what am I offering Krishna? Warmth? Am I giving him some water? Am I giving him some nice fragrances? And engaging in that. So what's the difference between just liking sweet rice and being attached to sweet rice? Absolutely. Whereas with attachment, if you don't get it, you miss it. Absolutely. So if I'm attached to sweet rice, then in the absence of sweet rice, I wonder if somebody's making sweet rice for dessert at the temple today. Right? You miss it. So when we have attachment to Krishna, we miss his presence. We're not even at bhav yet. We miss him. I'm missing. Why is Krishna not here? Why can't I feel his presence? Let me read something to remind me of him. Let me hear his names. Let me call him. Yeah? Let me worship him. Let me make something for him. Let me work for him. Let me think of him everywhere, wherever I am. Oh yeah, I know I have to maintain this body. I know I have to do so many things. But what can I also do to think of Krishna? The thing is, Krishna's a rascal. Sorry, Krishna. He's a rascal. I'm just repeating Radharani. He's a rascal because the same technique of kind of, okay, I'll give you a little bit and then I'll run away, that he does to increase our hankering for him, he does even at those stages. Like he does now. He gives us mercy, we find it easy to engage, then he removes himself. He gives us a taste for... Every step, he teases us like this. He gives us a little, then removes himself. Gives us a little more, removes himself. Gives us the next, removes himself. Because this is how one of the ways in which he keeps our relationship with him alive. So when he removes himself, in the many ways, whether that's at Vaidhi Bhakti, whether it's at Raghunuga Bhakti, he's doing it to increase our hankering. I wanted to share just three tips that can help us to, wherever we're at, whether we're at the very beginning, the middle, or extremely advanced, what can really help us is that one of the first things that can help us is, are we arranging our time in such a way and our activities in such a way that it maximizes our opportunities to engage in the process of pure devotional service? Okay, time management is a skill that is very important in Krishna consciousness, not just because we have to be on the altar on time and Krishna is time, but when we are using the principle of what's going to help me remember Krishna the most and not forget him, then making room in our schedule to actually engage in sadhana bhakti properly, whether that's at Vaidhi or Raghunuga, is really important, because what it shows Krishna is that we have a desire to get to know him. We may not be feeling it yet, but we can show him. Yeah, love is not just a feeling. Love is also thoughts. Love is also planning. And love is also actions. So if we can look at our schedules, so, you know, take an honest inventory of our schedules, and really look at, have I designed my life in such a way that I can really engage in this rehabilitation program called pure devotional service? Because for many of us, what happens is, in the beginning when we start, because our attraction is very strong, it's very new, it's raw, it's attraction, but it's very in its immature stages. But even in its immature stages, we're able to give priority to many of our Krishna conscious activities. Yes, because that feeling drives it. Much like an infatuation, your feeling drives, oh, I'm going to put that person first. Still quite self-centered, because it's our feeling, right? How that person makes us feel. But for it to be sustained and deeper, when that feeling, that you know, dizzy, buzzy, woo, Casey, you know, I'm on that pure devotional syndrome, nectar blissed out space, when that passes, then Krishna says, okay, show me your love in action. Show me you will make space and time for me and activities related to me. So it means readjustment of our schedule, which also means then the next step, which is an honest inventory of our priorities. What an honest inventory of our priorities allows us to do is show us which aspects of ourselves we are addicted to the most. Okay, you can be addicted to alcohol for many different reasons. Sometimes people get addicted to alcohol out of habit. Some people are addicted on a very physiological, biological level. You remove it and they actually literally go into a state of fit. Okay, their body starts to fit. Some people are addicted to alcohol and their relationship is in such a way that actually that alcohol serves as a emotional balm. It soothes their distressing feelings, at least temporarily, even though it increases them afterwards. So why are we addicted to this identity? What is it that we love about being ourselves here so much? Is it the distress? Sometimes we like being distressed. Is it the fame? Is it the adoration? Is it our intellect? Okay, what is it that we're giving priority? Is it our family? What is it that we are worshipping before we worship Krishna? And have we put it first to such a degree that it doesn't leave enough room either time-wise for our sadhana, or leave enough room in our mind for us to be present during our sadhana, whichever aspects of us. So do you hear what I'm saying? It's not just about clearing time in our schedule, it's about clearing space within ourselves, that we can be present during our sadhana. It's no quicker to chant inattentive rounds than it is to chant attentive rounds. In fact, actually being attentive is... saves you time, if that motivates anyone to be attentive. Any activity done with attention is done more efficiently and more quickly. Okay? And last thing is if we find ourselves struggling in our spiritual life, I mean, there's lots of tools, but the reason I want to give three is these three can be acted on quite quickly, and people often don't remember more than three as well. So the third one is, I've distracted myself now. The third one is that if we find ourselves struggling, go back to basics. What I often find is when devotees are struggling, we look for the most esoteric answer as to why we're struggling. Okay, maybe something happened in my past life. Right? Maybe, is this a test from Krishna? Or, you know, is he testing my purity? Is he using me as an example for others? This can't possibly be. We look for the most esoteric answer first. Okay. But the third thing is go to basics first. I'm not saying the esoteric answers shouldn't be looked at, but we shouldn't neglect the basic things first. If a house is falling down, the first place you look is the foundation. Right? So we look at our foundation. We go back to the first two. Have I got enough time in my schedule to perform my activities of pure devotional service? Secondly, have I done them in such a way that I've got mental space to be present when I'm engaging in the process of pure devotional service? And when we've looked at our foundation, then go to, is this something from my past life? Is this an offense I've committed? You know, should I go and get a regression? Is Krishna testing me? All of these things can come, you know, afterwards. Because usually, if we come back, let's say to our chanting, there's something is off. It might not be your quantity, it may be your quality. How can I improve my quality? It's easy to say, oh yeah, I need to be more attentive. Okay, but how? Why? What's distracting us? If we don't look at what's distracting us, nobody else is going to do it. Nobody's going to hold our hand. And this process gets better. Like I said, when we're honest with ourselves, we shed a lot of karmic patterns. Because what we're opening ourselves up to is mercy. Honesty opens us up. Okay, that's why we're scared to be honest, isn't it? Isn't that why we hide? The reason we can be dishonest is because we are scared to be open. We are scared to be vulnerable. But we forget that above every other power, above every person who could exploit our vulnerability, the little blue boy exploits our vulnerability the most, but he will do it in the most loving way. Because if we expose our vulnerabilities, allow him to come and he'll remove them because he'll see we're ready to let go of them the minute we're ready to be honest. So thank you so much for being an engaging audience. Do any of you have comments?